Tasmanian Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania.
And today, biosecurity to the fore after another varroa mite detection in the port of Townsville.
We suspect they're coming out of either Papua New Guinea or the Solomon Islands. As an industry, we've been concerned about this now, particularly with this new incursion. And so we'll certainly be talking with the federal government about what we can do to look at the pathways of these coming in.
And what about clam chowder for lunch?
I think it's just unique with its taste tenderness. Like, there's a lot of clams throughout Australia that are very tough in eating, but yeah, this is very good for seafood, chowders, pastas. Our legal size is 40 mil.
Tasmanian clams getting a gong in the 2020 Delicious Awards coming up shortly. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on this Thursday afternoon. Bit foggy in parts, but plenty of sunshine in other parts of the state. Hope you're enjoying your day, whatever you're doing. 0438 922 936 is our text number. 0438 922 936. Are you happy the federal government has scrapped the planned onshore biosecurity levy? It is an issue that needs some explaining. First up today, we'll discuss biosecurity, and the Australian government has now decided not to go ahead with the onshore biosecurity levy. To discuss that issue, Kath Sullivan, our rural reporter from Canberra, joins the Country Hour. How are you going, Kath?
Getting on well, thanks, Tony.
Excellent. Now, just explain what this levy, the onshore biosecurity levy, was all about. What was the plan originally?
Well, look, to be honest with you, Tony, you could be forgiven for having missed this one. A couple of years ago, Agriculture Minister David Littleproud actually announced it as part of the federal budget at the time, saying that the government was going to put a tax on inbound freight. It proposed about $10 per 20-foot shipping container and $1 per tonne of raw freight coming into the country, with the idea that it would raise about $325 million over 3 years to directly fund biosecurity screening services, so making sure that there's no pests and diseases coming into the country. And that was actually a response to an independent review that took place a year prior, which found that our biosecurity services are significantly underfunded. You know, biosecurity in this country underpins something like $60 billion worth of ag production every year, and maybe $40 million worth of inbound tourism. Of course, that being a non-COVID-19 year each year. So biosecurity, incredibly important, and the government had proposed to raise a lot more money to fund services this way, but it's never got off the ground. We never even saw the legislation. And yesterday, the department finally put the nail in the coffin and said it will not be going ahead.
Why did they do that, Kath?
Well, the official word from the department yesterday, Tony, was that having consulted with industry, and it didn't say which industry, it had found that the levy would have a significant impact on levy payers. Those were its words, I think. And it also said that it had arrived at this decision based on the economic impact that we're seeing from COVID-19, the bushfires and drought that's already having an impact on the Australian economy. The department also said that biosecurity services will still be funded at the same rate. It's just that they won't be funded through this levy. And I think it's worth pointing out at this time, Tony, once the levy was announced in that budget of 2018, we saw a lot of industry groups, the Minerals Council of Australia, the Australian Chamber of Commerce, freight groups, cruise ships, the Cement Federation, come out and say that they didn't like the levy design. They thought it was unfair, that it wasn't equitable with the risk that they presented in terms of biosecurity, and they suggested that they'd have to pass that cost on to consumers at the end of the chain. But the legislation never even appeared before the parliament, and as I say, now the government has agreed to walk away from this levy idea altogether.
Now, $325 million over 3 years, that was what the levy was going to raise, and the government now will get that money from somewhere?
Well, that's what it's saying. It's saying that biosecurity services won't be affected, detection services won't be affected by this decision to walk away from the levy. Another criticism that those industry groups had of the levy was that they said there was no way to determine if the money raised from it was actually, in fact, going to be spent on biosecurity services. So There were certainly a lot of questions raised about it, but we know that the National Farmers Federation, which was part of that working group consulting with both David Littleproud and Bridget McKenzie on this levy, had been pushing for it because it regularly pointed to the Wendy Craik review of 2017 and other reviews which have found that our biosecurity services are underfunded. And you just have to think, Tony, about how many times this year we've discussed things like African swine fever, issues with varroa mite, the fall armyworm, which has been detected in northern Australia. In fact, northern Australia has been hit particularly hard when you think of the white spot disease in prawns, the Panama disease in bananas. These are all things that have happened in 2020.
Yeah, well, we know how important biosecurity is to Tasmania. So, Kath, what should Tasmanian farmers be thinking about all of this with that levy now not going ahead?
Well, they can think whatever they like, of course. I think that the minister would say that the government's been very agile. It's responded to industry concerns that have been put by big importers of minerals and other things, and that it's, you know, decided that now is not the time to be creating a new tax when the Australian economy has been smashed around so hard. But the National Farmers Federation, in its response yesterday, said it's a terrible look for the Australian government to be chopping and changing as to how it does fundraise its biosecurity detection services. So I thought that was interesting. We don't often see the NFF critical. It's been a little while since the NFF's been critical of the Australian government. And I know that the government would say it does take biosecurity services incredibly seriously. And you can see in the last little while that it's certainly upped the penalties for people who are found to be importing or risking Australia's biosecurity. Just think of the woman from Tasmania who imported the illegally imported the garlic bulbs. Or perhaps there are some people who remember cases of tourists trying to enter Australia bringing in pork products who have in fact been sent home and told that they're not to be granted a visa back into Australia for some time. I guess you might say it's a little bit of mixed messaging in some ways, but the government is adamant it will continue to fund biosecurity services adequately.
Thank you, Kath, for your time as always.
Great to speak with you, Tony.
Our National Rural Reporter Kath Sullivan on the decision of the federal government to scrap the onshore biosecurity levy, which would have raised over $300 million for biosecurity in the country. Your thoughts on that decision? Love to know. 0438 922 936, our number. 0438 922 936. Are coming up some gongs for local seafood producers in the 2020 Delicious Awards. Well, we were just talking there about biosecurity, and there's been a biosecurity incursion in the North Queensland city of Townsville with another nest of Asian honeybees carrying the parasitic varroa mite found by local surveillance staff. The colony was located at the Port of Townsville by the National Varroa Mite Eradication Program. It's been exterminated, with the bees and varroa mites to be further tested to determine their origin. The varroa mite is estimated to threaten up to $8 billion worth of Australian food production, reliant on pollination by the European honeybee, which is highly susceptible to the mite. Our reporter Tom Major spoke to Trevor Weatherhead, who chairs the Australian Honeybee Industry Council's Quarantine and Disease Subcommittee, and says federal government action is needed to keep varroa out of Australia permanently.
Well, we weren't pleased that this has come about, but we're sort of pleased with the reaction that's been put in place by the team that's up there, and that they did find it, and that it has now been destroyed, and the chances of any more being around there at this stage are pretty slim.
4 years, I think, into the National Varroa Mite Eradication Program, and there's still these consistent finds being discovered around the Port of Townsville on a sort of annual basis, I guess. What does that tell you about the incursions, where they're coming from, and exactly what could be the way to stop them long term?
Well, certainly we suspect they're coming out of either Papua New Guinea or the Solomon Islands. Not a good situation. As an industry, we've been concerned about this now, particularly with this new incursion. And so we'll certainly be talking with the federal government about what we can do to look at the pathways of these coming in, and whether there's something that can be done on the port of embarkation where they're being, the containers and that are being loaded onto, to see if something can be done there to maybe not have these bees with the mites on them arrive here in Australia.
Has the federal government indicated at all whether that's feasible, or whether it's a bit of a too hard basket sort of issue given the volume of trade from those ports in particular coming into northern Australia?
I'm confident that, you know, we can work something out with them to try and get something in place to review the process of what's going on there now. So it's early days, and we'll be having those discussions with the federal government about what we can do to stop these coming in.
The levy system at the moment that funds the varroa mite eradication program, how does that work and what does that cost beekeepers?
Beekeepers pay a 4.6 cents per kilogram levy on the honey that's produced within Australia, and part of that goes towards the emergency plant pest response that is there. So that's where we fund the continuation of this eradication program in Townsville from. But the levy that we pay has been in place now for many years and will continue on it. If we're not paying for, like, incursions now, we're also paying for things like our National Bee Pest Surveillance Program that's in place to try and pick up any pests that come in. Plus, we also fund other programs out of it, so that levy will stay in place. It's just that we won't be contributing anything towards a varroa eradication program, but be able to put the money into the other programs that we have.
Is that a likely occurrence, do you believe, or do you think until there is some sort of concrete work to prevent the Asian honeybee from occurring again at the Port of Townsville, this program will have to continue?
Well, the program, as you said, is in place now until April next year, and I'm sure that in light of this recent program, they'll be looking at the program again and seeing how we're going to go with the response plan, so there'll be some movement in that area.
And the honey industry in general, how is it sitting at the moment Australia-wide with regard to biosecurity issues? Are you confident in the future of the honey industry to prevent any future and further biosecurity threats similar to varroa mite?
Well, we're working hard within our industry to look at all these particular issues and identify the biosecurity threats that are out there. As I say, we have the thing called the National Bee Pest Surveillance Program. It's in place there, and part of that is surveillance hives at ports and doing work to make sure that we don't have any other biosecurity issues. So we keep looking at what else is possible threats from around the world and look at how we can address them and stop them from getting into Australia. We've been fortunate so far with the other varroa mite, the varroa destructor, that we haven't got it into Australia yet. We're the only country in the world that doesn't have it. We just keep looking at all the different processes around and looking at these threats and making sure there's processes in place to try and keep us free of those pests.
Are resistant breeds the future, do you believe, or is keeping varroa out still the number one priority?
Keeping varroa out is certainly the number one priority, that's for sure.
Trevor Weatherhead, he chairs a subcommittee tackling quarantine and disease issues for the Australian Honeybee Industry Council. Speaking there to Tom Major about the varroa mite incursion at the Port of Townsville. Now, talking bees, later in the program we'll introduce you to the grumpy bee. But in a moment, some niche Tasmanian seafood products getting noticed at the 2020 Delicious Awards. This is the Tasmanian Country Hour.
In a world of uncertainty, it's more important than ever to stay connected.
Congratulations to the ABC. Once again, outstanding reporting.
We're with you for breaking news.
The number of cases we're seeing emerge every day, there's definitely been a decline.
The Aussie spirit can't be broken.
Were there a few drinks involved during the Zoom session?
No, there were lots of cups of tea.
Stay safe, stay connected, stay informed with Australia's most trusted news source. ABC News, we're with you.
The Tasmanian Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania.
And we'll talk about a gathering of the Tasmanian women in agriculture in the cloud very shortly. Well, Tasmanian seafood producers are looking forward to offloading their premium catch to restaurants again as they start to open back up. It was sea urchin roe harvested on the east coast that caught the attention of judges in the 2020 Delicious Produce Awards. Renison Bell from 42 South Fishing Company was one of two state winners in the sea category.
Over the last few years, we have been harvesting both species, which fortunately for us, they are in season at different times of the year, both species of urchins. We generally started off selling them whole to processors who then ran through the process of removing the roe and then marketing it themselves, which was fine. And then from there we've had people approaching us to sell them in small volume the live sea urchin, so unprocessed. And from there we've had people ask us, can we do processing ourselves for the small, you know, boutique restaurant industry? So we've branched out into all three all three styles, I suppose, of the fishery in that way.
And for the boutique end, what is it supposed to look like when you deliver it to them to turn into something beautiful?
Rightio, so each urchin has five tongues of roe in it. Generally, we're selling to the restaurants who want an ultra-high-end quality product. We're sending small punnets between 30 and 50 grams to the restaurant of ultra-high quality stuff, and then they normally serve it probably as an entree dish, so a standalone dish on maybe a little bit of bread or some rice, or it could be mixed through a pasta for a main meal. But generally, it's a standalone item on a menu.
So when you're diving for these urchins, how do you know that that one's going to fetch you some good money? What's the look about the urchin itself?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question. We do a lot of opening shells underwater. When we're swimming, we don't just take everything we see. Obviously, the beautiful colour, a really fine grain to the roe is what we're ultimately looking for. So to find that, we're breaking urchins open when we're diving, and the quality and the colour can change rapidly depending on depth, habitat, even just the aspect of the bottom, which way it's facing, different tides, different weed types. So even the rock ranging from granite to that black volcanic rock, any little change in the bottom will change the colour and consistency of the urchin roe.
And you primarily dive across the east coast?
Pretty much, yes. That's where the long spines are predominantly on the east coast, and so much over the short spines as well. There are some short spines along the north of the state, but generally most of the fishing for both species is the east coast, yeah.
When you entered the awards, where were your urchins ending up? What was the market?
So the small process stuff was going to restaurants, and the live stuff was predominantly going to Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane. But yes, we also do sell stuff, some bulk stuff to other processors to process that roe as well. When the COVID stuff sort of hit us, everyone obviously panicked. Restaurants were shutting, so the brakes got put on the whole business very quickly. So that's probably then a lot of the boutique stuff probably outshone more so then, because it wasn't so much a quantity game; it was a high quality stuff. So we were still able to move that product until the air freight stopped. So that was another hiccup in the supply chain. But now over the last couple of weeks, it's things have really started to ramp back up. Everyone's, you know, things are opening. Everyone's getting a bit more relaxed, and people are going out and wanting to try new things. So it's been a bit of a rollercoaster in the last few months.
You can see some shifts there, for example, with your product going to China.
Yes, we're sort of very lucky. A lot of it does go to China, but that also a lot of the export stuff does go to other Asian countries, Japan, Vietnam, Singapore, Malaysia. So it's, which were also affected, but not so much as China. So it's because it is a high-end product, it has been affected, but probably not so, a sort of massive kilo volume. So you're not sending thousands of tons of product. It's processed down to a small, lightweight roe. So it has been hard over the last few months, but we're certainly seeing the other end of the tunnel at the moment.
What does it mean to be a state finalist in the Delicious Awards?
Well, I'm very proud and honoured to be to get that, but I'm probably more so excited for the whole commercial dive fishery. You know, it's an accolade and a win for the whole, you know, for the whole urchin fishery. Anyway, we can all ride off the coattails. It's the same product, processed in different ways, of course. But that, I'm very excited about it. But I'm probably more so excited for all the other fishermen involved in it too.
Yeah. Do you think for some time it's sort of been a bit of an underrated part of the seafood industry, what you do as divers?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's a massive part of it, and this fishery in particular has been underrated and understated for a long time. It's only been the last few years where it's really really started to get traction.
Commercial diver Renison Bell from 42 South Fishing Company, one of the state winners in the Delicious Produce Awards. And I've just done a straw poll of Country Hour staff about urchin roe and whether they'd love to have it for lunch today. and not the most popular lunchtime feed amongst the staff. They would rather pass. You might have different thoughts. 0438 922 936. 0438 922 936. Do you like urchin roe? Well, we'll stay on Tasmania's east coast because Dale Ridges from Mollusca Seafoods was another state winner. He's been commercially harvesting Phanerupus clam in Georges Bay for more than 30 years.
The history started around about 1985, trying to promote these things into the market, which was very, very slow for a while. So, yeah, mainly Melbourne and Sydney, that was the main market base for us, not many sold in Tasmania at that stage.
What sets it apart from other clams that are found in Australia?
I think it's just unique with its taste, tenderness. Like, there's a lot of clams throughout Australia that are very tough in eating, but, yeah, this is very good for seafood, chowders, pastas. Yeah, just, you know, clam.
How big does it grow to?
Our legal size is 40 mil. So 40 mil up to nearly 80 mil, some of them.
And you're diving for these in Georges Bay, that predominantly this is the main area where this species is found?
Yes, it is the main area where they're found, yeah. In the main channel of Georges Bay, main thoroughfare channel, which is about maybe 4, 5 and up to 6 metres deep.
You're not diving as deep as you would for, a spine sea urchin?
No, exactly.
Easy to collect?
Yes, but very hard work on the tide. The tide runs at 4 or 5 knots, so you've got to swim against the tide, and that's the time to catch them. So it's easier to work to move the substrate to collect the clams. They're in the sand, so they're probably submerged maybe about 20 to 30 mil under the sand, so you've actually got to sweep the sand away. You see the siphon holes through the sand, and that's how you identify where they are.
So it's fairly time-consuming then?
Can be, depending on whether you'll find them in dense areas or not.
What do they retail for?
Well, the price has actually gone up over the last maybe 12 months to 18 months, so you're looking at maybe $40 a kilo.
And this is into the restaurant trade?
Yes.
What's happened for you in the last couple of months in the interim?
As there's no restaurants, things have been very, very tough. But, hopefully in the next maybe month, things will start moving again. So, yeah, I've just been diving for sea urchins.
Yeah, so most of your clams are sort of sold into the Melbourne, Sydney markets?
Not so much now. So there's been a big demand over the last couple of years in Tasmania, and I have sold to Melbourne, Sydney for the past like 25, 30 years, and big demand from in Tasmania now. So I've actually dragged them out of Melbourne, Sydney, and selling to restaurants in Tasmania, which I think is great for our situation here.
What's driving that turnaround? Why do you think there's been a shift in interest?
Not real sure. I have been pestered for a long time to sell them in Tasmania, and just obligated to sell to my market that's been loyal to me in Melbourne, Sydney. Yeah, so then things change, and you're trying to drive forward in Tasmania now.
What is their shelf life from when you do take them out of the bay and get them to the restaurants?
Shelf life's maybe about 5 days, but you can freeze them. They do freeze very well.
Were you pretty pleased to get the nod from the Delicious Awards as a state winner?
Yes, it was very surprising. Actually, Simone Miller from Solo put me forward. He is one of the guys that has been buying my clams over the past 12 months, 14 months in Tasmania, and promoting them very well for me. So, look, I was very ecstatic with that.
Are you hoping that this will lead to, you know, more opportunities within, you know, markets opening up because of this recognition?
Oh, look, absolutely. You know, it's been a very hard road from like 30 years ago trying to drive this product forward yourself, but when you get recognition like this, I think that it pushes a lot more buttons for you.
Dale Ridges from Mollusca Seafoods on the East Coast speaking to Larissa Smith about the Phanerupus clam. Great idea for lunch today, clam chowder. Still to come in the Country Hour, a donation of spuds to help the needy from the Fourth Side Vegetable Research Station. Now, time to tell you about a special gathering for Tasmanian women in agriculture, which will take place tomorrow. And it will be a gathering in the cloud. And to tell us more, Belinda Hazel from the Tas Women in Ag joins the Country Hour. G'day, Belinda.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
I'm going very well, thank you. And I think we're getting used to these online meetings. Tell us about this one.
We moved the gathering to the cloud. It's actually on the 23rd of May, which is this coming weekend. We would have been meeting together as a group. Normally we would meet every 2 years, but we decided that because of the disruption that everybody's going through, that we'd harness the power of technology and have a short gathering in the cloud, so 23rd of May, and really lucky to have keynote speaker Pip Courtney, who we know is a well-loved host at ABC Landline. She's going to be talking about how agribusiness is evolving, particularly during recent events, and how these businesses are telling their stories. And then we are going to have Todd Babiak from Brand Tasmania, who will be speaking about how to build your own brand and message. We're also lucky enough to have the Minister for Primary Industry, Guy Barnett, who's also going to provide us with a welcome and an update on the government's competitiveness white paper and how the network can engage with that.
How many participants are you expecting, Belinda? And is there a limit on Saturday?
There's a limit on the webinar of around 100. So what we'll do is we'll record that and we'll make it available to our network following the event. But we would love to have that capacity reached just so that we can maintain the connection with our group during this time.
Okay, now these meetings are great from the point of view of catering, but you do miss the face-to-face discussion of how meetings used to be. You think online has totally taken over for these sorts of things and that will be the way of the future?
It is a new way to some people of doing business, Tony. One of the things that we've maintained during this time is ensuring that we're connecting with our network. So we've been holding paddock talks initially every week. Now they've been every fortnight on different subjects that we know that the network's wanting some information about. And that information, those paddock talks are available again on our website. And it is really key that we maintain connection. We're all evolving and changing in different ways. And I think it's going to be a different way for us to do business in the future. This is going to be something that we're all going to be familiar with.
And Belinda, from what you're hearing, how are rural people coping with the lockdown, especially those involved in rural tourism?
It's not easy. And that's one thing that we need to make sure as a community that we engage and connect as we go through these different stages that the government's asking us to follow. I think the key thing is to ensure that we do reach out and check in with people and ask them if they're okay and support local businesses. And one of the initiatives that I know is available is Rural Alive and Well. I know that you would have had them talk a lot on your program, but I encourage anybody in our network, anybody that is having some concern, to reach out to the support providers that are there because they've got some great tools and resources available to help our network. The main message I have is get out and when we can through the different stages that we are required to follow and support local business.
Great talking to you, Belinda. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Tony.
Belinda Hazel from Tasmanian Women in Agriculture. And if you want more information, that website is the best place to go. Let's check the latest on the weather now with Matthew Thomas from the Bureau. G'day, Matthew.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
Yeah, going well. Rainfall figures, have we got any?
Look, yes, there was a fair bit about the north and the west. So we had two cold fronts across Tasmania yesterday with the second crossing yesterday evening. And to 9 a.m. we saw very good falls of 10 to 20 millimetres about the north and the west, with 40 millimetres being the highest reported on Mount Barrow. There was 28 millimetres at Lake Margaret and 20 millimetres at Launceston. About the southeast and the east, the amounts were far more modest, with most sites being closer to 1 millimetre. We're currently in a westerly airstream, and since 9 a.m. we've seen some showers about the west, which has brought about 1 to 3 millimetres to most locations about the west of the state.
Okay, now the outlook.
Okay, so the current situation, we've got a high-pressure system building over the Bight. An area of low pressure is going to form off the New South Wales coast later today. So there's a good mass of cloud just lying off Sydney, and that will form into a low today. And we've got a fairly light westerly stream that will ease through today into tomorrow. Will become dominated by those two features, the high to our west and the low to our northeast, and that will continue for the outlook period, with the high slowly approaching and moving to the south of the state by the end of the period. So for the remainder of today, we can expect just some showers about the west and the far south, fine elsewhere. We're looking at around 1 to 5 millimetres in total around the west of the state and less than a millimetre about the far south. Very slight chance of some convergent showers about the northeast, far northeast corner, just inland from Eddiston Point later this afternoon, but there won't be terribly much in that if it does occur. Into tomorrow, with the stream easing back, those showers into the west will contract more to the coast, and so we'll have some showers about the west of the state and fine conditions elsewhere, but we will have morning frost patches, so it will be a cold start, particularly about the northern Midlands, the central north and Fingal Valley. And so we have issued a frost warning with temperatures, minimum temperatures overnight, expected to get down to about -1 in some of those areas. So there's a frost warning out for the central north Midlands and the east coast forecast district for tomorrow morning with the chance of frost there. Into Saturday, the weak westerly flow will continue as the high pressure system just moves a little bit closer, but we will have a cold front come and just brush the south of the state as the flow tends more southerly. And so we will see some showers about the west and the south, mainly fine conditions elsewhere, just around 2 to 5 millimetres about the west and less than 2 millimetres about the south. Showers will begin to build about the east coast later on Saturday into Sunday as we move more from a southerly to a southeasterly airstream, and we'll see some showers about the east and the southeast, fine conditions elsewhere. The high pressure system will just be to our southwest and the low will remain over the Tasman Sea on Sunday, and then the high will move over the state into Monday. We'll maintain showers about the east and the southeast and fine conditions elsewhere. Will be some frost about on Monday as well. And that's the weather.
Okay, now you've did a few warnings there. Any other warnings, Matthew?
Look, in terms of the warnings, what we've got for today, there's a strong wind warning for southern coastal waters from Tasman Island to Low Rocky Point. For tomorrow, it's just that frost warning for parts of the central north, Midlands and the east coast forecast districts.
Okay. Coastal waters and swell, what's happening there?
Okay, for today, west to southwesterly winds of 10 to 20 knots, reaching 20 to 30 knots about the south until late afternoon. Into tomorrow, the stream will ease back a little bit, and west to southwesterly winds of 10 to 15 knots, reaching 20 knots about the south until early afternoon. And the winds about the east will tend southerly at 10 to 15 knots, but increase to 20 knots offshore east of Flinders Island late as that low pressure system off the New South Wales coast begins to intensify. In terms of the swells, we do have quite a bit of swell with those fronts that crossed yesterday. So we've got a southwesterly swell about the west and the south, which is currently around 5 to 6 metres, and that will decay through tomorrow to be near 4 metres by tomorrow evening. About the north is a south to southwesterly swell of 1 to 1.5 metres. There's also a northeasterly of around 0.5 metre that will build east of Flinders Island to 1 to 1.5 metres late tomorrow. About the north, there's a westerly swell of 1 to 1.5 metres that will decay slightly through tomorrow. In terms of the current observations, a wave rider buoy at Cape Sorel is showing a significant wave of 5.4 metres, a maximum wave of 8.6 metres and a 14-second period.
Good on you, Matthew. Thank you for that.
Okay, see you later.
See you later, Matthew Thomas from the Bureau with the latest information for you on the country. Our Grumpy Bee coming up and a spud donation. But talking cattle now, and Australia's largest cattle company, AA Co, is back in the black, reporting a full-year net profit after tax of $31.3 million, representing a huge turnaround of about $180 million on the previous year's loss. There are some uncertain times ahead for the company, and it's already suffered losses because of China's import ban on 4 Aussie abattoirs. But the company's CEO, Hugh Killen, is feeling upbeat. He spoke to Matt Brann.
Yes, we've had a very strong financial year 20. A couple of things have led to it. One is our focus on our branded beef exports globally has really starting to bear fruit, and that's a strategy that takes some time to implement, and now starting to come through now. Secondly, even with an extra $42 million worth of costs from the drought, we've managed to control costs across our business, and that's been very positive in terms of operating cash flow as well. And, you know, I think the whole company is actually really starting to come together well. The issue we've got is, I think, what is a very strong performance this year is probably going to be overshadowed somewhat by COVID-19 and the pandemic.
China's import beef ban on 4 Aussie abattoirs. What impact has that had on your company?
Yeah, so the listing of the 4 abattoirs that have been announced, one of those abattoirs does about 60% of our production into China, so there's been an impact for us there, but we do process beef at another plant, so we've still got about a third of our production that's going to China at the moment. So from that perspective, it's just another challenge that we have to deal with, Matt.
So the two-thirds of the China meat sales that have been impacted, where do you plan to send that beef?
We're very lucky that we've got good relationships in countries such as Korea. I'm not sure if your listeners are aware, Matt, we've got a 15-year relationship there with one of the largest supermarket chains there called E-Mart. And our Darling Downs Wagyu brand is a household name in Korea, actually literally all over Korea. And so there's options like that for us to place China product into there as well. The other thing that's really important to understand is about half of what we put to China is trim. And the trim market in the US is very, very buoyant at the moment, given the challenges they're having in processing there, ironically enough. So it gives us an opportunity to redivert to markets like that as well.
Since the global pandemic began, how much of AACo's beef is getting redirected into the supermarkets?
So one of the things we've been doing today is trying to be really clear in terms of where our what our channel mix looks like. And about half of what we do today already goes into what we call retail channels, which supermarkets are the largest part of it. And I've just referenced Korea there as well, which is an example of that. And it's a very significant market. And that takes about $69 million worth of our beef a year. And that literally all goes into supermarkets and retail. So we already have that's about 50% of what we do. What we're working through now because of COVID-19 and the impact on food service is how do we pivot more into not just supermarkets but also into direct-to-consumer and other opportunities in terms of pivoting out of the food service business.
Because looking at the report today, certainly one of the shining lights is the increased Wagyu beef sales. But right now, with the global restaurant trade at a standstill, where is the Wagyu going?
Well, clearly food service is, if it's not at a standstill, it's pretty heavily impacted, or very heavily impacted, I should say. Now, Wagyu is generally seen as a centre of plate item into food service. What we are seeing in this environment, however, is that consumers absolutely want high quality, high provenance product that comes from supply chains that are genuinely paddock to plate, and they're willing to pay for products. And so what's been very heartening is that, especially in direct to consumer, there is a lot of demand for our product, our Wagyu product, especially in Asia, and we're seeing the same into the US now as well. So while it's the traditional restaurant product, we're seeing people paying very good pricing for our Wagyu cuts now, which is heartening. I would say I don't want to overplay that. Food service is at the heart of our 40 to 50% of our business, and we'll protect those brands going forwards. But
are you sitting on a lot of good steak at the moment?
No, our inventory levels aren't too bad at the moment, to be honest with you. And as I said, we have very, very mature supply chains. And one of the benefits that AACo's got is that it is large. It is global. We have diversification across basically every market in the world, and that gives us some flexibility, plus that mix between retail and food service. But as we said before in our results today, it is going to be very difficult to estimate the full impact so far in relation to the food service shutdown.
The current herd size for AACo, Hugh, it's down nearly 20% on last year. Is that purely a sign of the drought?
Yeah, it's actually down 19%. I would say there are three impacts to our herd size. Number one will be obviously the ongoing impact of drought and that on fertility. Secondly will be the impact of the Gulf flooding event that we had as well, and that's our big breeder herd over there as well. So that's had an impact there. And then the third thing that's actually not as evident to people outside of AACo is we've made a decision to bring all of our production in internally. And so that means that the cattle numbers have gone down a little bit because of that. But the one thing I would say is even though our cattle numbers are down, they're largely trading animals, and the nucleus of our breeding herd is largely intact, which is obviously a key part of our proposition.
So a herd size of around 346,000 head. When's the last time AACo's herd size was that low?
I'd have to actually go and have a look at that, Matt, to be honest with you. Obviously, not in my time. I make no excuses for making AACo simpler and made more efficient, and if that means we need to have less cattle to do that, that's the right thing to do. The important thing to look at as we go forward is how much margin we grow in the business and positive operating cash flow. The other side of it as well is, you know, I think while our herd numbers will probably go up again in the next little while as brandings come through out of this season, you know, I think AACo's big mega numbers that had way before my time was probably too many. So I think, you know, we will moderate at or around these numbers. Maybe, you know, we'll see what happens.
Hugh Killen, the CEO of the Australian Agricultural Company, talking there to Matt Brannan. More details of that story on ABC Rural Online. Well, have you ever wondered what happens to food that is grown in scientific trials? This year, potatoes grown at the Forsyth Vegetable Research Facility in the Northwest were donated to some of the people doing it tough during coronavirus restrictions. Here's farm manager Doug Clark.
We had about 12 tonne of potatoes available to pretty much give away, which has been good, be able to help the community in that. So that's gone up to a couple of people in Launceston, a couple of community groups up there, a group in Burnie, a group in Devonport, and also to UTAS in Launceston as well.
So they were donated to people who needed it most. How was it received?
Yeah, really well. There's a few people out there that are doing it pretty hard at the moment. So, yeah, all the information I've seen back on Facebook and from those groups, they really appreciate the support. So.
So if people might not know, you run a vegetable research farm up there in Forth, and you had 12 tonnes, and I'm assuming it was from a trial?
Yeah, correct. There's two different components of that. So the fresh market varieties were a result of seed testing that TasSeed had done for Generation 2 potatoes last season. So we held on to some of that seed and grew that out. And the second component was russet Burbanks for a trial that Mark Borsmer and Intertech Pivot were doing on site.
Did the trials go all right?
Yeah, absolutely. So with the Intertech Pivot trial, there's definite results in that, which is always good. Sometimes with the research trials, you can end up with stuff that aren't clearly identified as a result, but those ones were pretty good.
And you do lots of trials all the time with not just potatoes. What usually happens to things you grow in trials?
Yeah, that's right. One of the best part of the job is you get to grow different vegetables. So we do a lot of pea and bean variety assessments. So that sort of product gets donated back into Paul here at Paul's Hope in Devonport. Yeah, it's the only thing we can use and put back into the community, we do where we can.
And some trials, I suppose, wouldn't be appropriate to give back, though?
No, absolutely right. No, it's anything that's borderline, we certainly, we incorporate that back into the soil because we don't want that entering the food system at all.
How is everything going up there at the research farm? I imagine you're quite busy this time of year.
Look, like to be busier. The amount of water we've had getting around the place has been very irritating for getting in next season's crop, but certainly the hippopotamus have come out to play in the mud, that's for sure.
what trials have you got coming up there at the farm?
Yeah, so next season we've earmarked some hemp trials. Looks like there'll be some more potato work happening. Certainly more poppy work. Scott's doing some work on that. Pea and bean variety assessments. We've also got some stuff, onion seed variety trials, and also some potato ones as well.
That's Doug Clark, managing the Tasmanian Vegetable Research Facility at Forsyth. Speaking there to Hugh Hogan.
On ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania, you're with Tony Briscoe for the Tasmanian Country Hour.
Now, if you're a beekeeper, you spend International Bee Day with the bees, of course. And that was no different to one Huon Valley beekeeper yesterday who had to travel to the rainforest area to move the bees for winter.
Okay, I'm Ross Gordon. I'm a beekeeper based in the Huon Valley at Crabtree. I have bees just about all over the state, wherever there's leatherwood, certainly. Southern forests on the west coast and the Picton, Upper Derwent. Been in the game for 8 or 9 years now in this part of the world. I did it as a child in Africa as well.
And you spent International Bee Day with the bees, of course.
Yes. Ironic.
Did they know it was International Bee Day?
No. No, they weren't happy.
They weren't happy?
They don't love being moved.
So what did you have to do?
The reason rainforest is called rainforest is because it rains so much. So if you leave them there in winter, it's too cold and too wet. So you sort of move them out of the rainforests in time for winter and put them back again come summer when the stuff starts flowering.
Is that the place where the name Grumpy Bee came from?
No. No, strangely. Grumpy Bee came from our original logo. We didn't have a name yet, and I asked commissioned my daughter to paint me one. And the bee that she painted looked grumpy, so that was what we got the name from.
So the moniker's stuck, and how important these bees?
Food production. Just disregard honey production, because I'm sure we could all probably survive without honey. In terms of their pollination, humanity would be in huge trouble if we didn't have bees. Depending where you are and what you eat, upwards sort of 70% and upwards of what we eat is dependent on bees for pollination. So we'd be in all sorts of trouble without them.
How's the season gone this year? It was pretty rugged the last couple of years, wasn't it?
Last year in particular, it was shockingly bad. We had drought to contend with, and then fires as well. So we've lost a lot of resource. Some people, not me, thankfully, lost a lot of bees, both to fire and from not being able to tend to them because the roads were closed. We started the season still in drought, technically, so this sort of spring honey flow didn't happen. And frankly, spring didn't really happen either, for that matter. Eucalypts flowered quite well this year, so some people got honey from blue gum, for instance, in spring, but out in the forest there wasn't much happening. And then, thankfully, the leatherwood finally, for the first time in a couple of years, flowered beautifully, so that made up for the deficit to some extent. Best quality leatherwood we've had for ages.
And you do Monica honey too, don't you?
Yes.
What do you think of the fight with New Zealand with the name?
You know, I have to toe the line because I'm just a small cog in a bigger wheel here in Tasmania. So I toe the line, and we need to fight that. There's no good reason for them to claim it as their own, deny other people using it when we all have the same species of Manuka, and when we all have been calling it that for far back in written history as we can find in Tasmania, long good 100 and something years. The tea tree has been called Manuka here. You know, I'm a little bit indifferent. You know, if we end up calling it leptospermum or something else, I think it would give us an opportunity to differentiate it from the New Zealand one. So I have mixed feelings about it, but officially I toe the line. I think we should fight to the bitter end, and it looks like we'll win anyway. We've won most of the cases so far.
How many hives have you got, Ross?
250-something.
Is that enough? Are you going to expand, get more, or...?
For a one-person operation, it's as much as I can cope with. If I get more, I have to do a sort of cost-benefit analysis of, you know, how many more do I have to employ a person, and then it becomes sort of exponentially gets bigger after that because you need a certain number for every employee. So, yeah, at my age, if I was a little bit younger, I wouldn't even have to think about it. But at the moment, I'm thinking, well, maybe I should just stop for a while at least.
And has the COVID outbreak, has that caused you problems with marketing the honey? Have you had to do something different?
We've had to change to online. We've gone online. The tourists, which used to buy a lot of, especially Manuka, they're just not there. So that's it's hurting a little bit, but, you know, not as much as I would have expected. And we're making up the deficit with online sales.
That's Ross Gordon from the Grumpy Bee in the Huon, moving the bees out of the rainforest and coping with COVID-19 and the changes to marketing the honey. Well, amongst all the craziness of the droughts, fires and the COVID-19 pandemic, there are rural leaders out there working hard to produce food and fibre. More than ever, they deserve recognition, and the ABC is doing just that through the 2020 Farmer of the Year Awards. Sally Downey won the student category of the awards last year. She's an ag science student at Charles Sturt University, based at a farm at Trundle in central west New South Wales. She took on a role as drought coordinator and told Josh Becker winning the award gave her a confidence boost.
When I first found out, I was really shocked. I obviously knew there was a Farmer of the Year award, but I wasn't aware of the student section, and I didn't even know I'd been nominated, so I definitely got a good shock out of it. But, yeah, it was a really good experience being able to go to Canberra and meet so many people and learn about others' involvement in the industry and connect with them, as well as a lot of other service providers and everyone, how they're all intertwined into our industry. And I guess it was a really good confidence boost to going with university as a distance education student. You kind of feel a bit isolated. Sometimes it just becomes a bit too stressful and you're like, why am I even doing this? So it was a great confidence boost to be recognised, and it certainly has helped me with that drive to continue my studies.
You're recognised as a great advocate for rural people with a focus around mental health and getting support for that in rural and remote areas. How's your work in that space been over the past 12 months? It's been a pretty challenging year for many people involved in ag.
Yeah, it certainly has. And I think it's an ever-changing environment, so my role in that has changed considerably in the last 12 months. As a drought coordinator, I was interacting with people one-on-one, and I obviously had that as huge focus, just checking in on them, keeping contacts, helping where I can to relieve that pressure of drought wherever possible. And there's a huge mental health side to that, and I saw that firsthand, but also experienced it firsthand being off the farm and having to go through the drought as well. I then think as I step away from that role, you know, it still continues because there's so much work to be done.
Now that you've finished up in that role as drought coordinator and you look back on the work that you achieved, are there any thoughts that you have about what's needed in future droughts?
I think there's enormous amount of work to be done. That was one of the huge frustrations I had in that role, that you did feel limited. Like, there were so many things that had to be changed, that this isn't the only drought we're ever going to be seeing. In a few years' time, I hate to think it, but we don't know what kind of situation we'll be in, and drought is a possibility, and we've got to be ready for that. And I got a lot of farmers coming to me being frustrated that the support there is there, but there's always challenges with it, and things just seem inadequate. And I think there's so much to do in having a conversation around how we deal with drought and making sure that we've just come out of what, you know, some people say is the worst drought in 100 years. Well, we need to learn from that, and we need to apply that knowledge. And one good season, it's not going to change everything. And we need to not just forget that we've been through that and not make any changes. It starts from home on our farms. It starts in our community. But it also needs to be lobbying to the government to get that support, particularly when you start comparing it to the coronavirus, which I know has been a topic of discussion lately. I thought that from my personal experience, that that's a huge thing that we need to learn from and compare and see what we can do, because we know there's going to be another drought. We can't forget what we learnt, and we need to move forward and be better prepared for the next one.
Sally Downey, Ag Science students and one of the 2019 Farmer of the Year winners. Now, it's very important. It's coming towards the end of nomination, so you can still nominate, and we'd like you to nominate somebody who's a fantastic ag student, or someone you know, or yourself, or an ag researcher. Those two categories, just part of the categories of the Farmer of the Year Awards. Farmeroftheyear.com.au is the place to go.